From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made this past March when President Donald Trump demanded that Mexico do more to help the United States rid itself of MS-13 gang members. The president said, quote, MS-13 gang members are being removed by our great ICE and Border Patrol agents by the thousands, but these killers come back in from El Salvador and through Mexico like water. El Salvador just takes our money, and Mexico must help more with this problem. We need the wall. End quote. Well, throughout his presidency, the president has pointed to MS-13 as emblematic of the threat of undocumented immigration, particularly from and through Mexico. So what is actually going on? It can be difficult for most of us, me included, to understand the reality on the ground. There are questions about the opioid crisis, heroin, drug movement. There are questions about rival cartels and systems to move around the border area. And there are questions about what kinds of policy make sense. What kind of partnership is going on between the United States and Mexico? Today, Eric Olson is in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester, which is an affiliate of the World Affairs Councils of America. Olson is Deputy Director of the Latin American Program and Senior Advisor to the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. His research and writing is focused on security issues and the impacts of crime, organized crime, and violence on democratic governance. And tonight he's offering a presentation in Rochester titled Mexico's Evolving Criminal Landscape and What It Says About the U.S. We'll tell you more about that coming up. First, he's my guest on Connections and basically told me all questions are on the table except for NAFTA. You're a security guy. Fair enough there?
That's fair enough. Thank you.
You're not an economist. I know you're in security, but thank you for taking the time. I know you just got to Rochester, so thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
And I don't want to bog down this hour on sort of the tit-for-tat of politics, but I do think it will be instructive to at least start there with questions a lot of people have who don't closely follow what's going on to the border, border crossings, U.S.-Mexico relations, dealing with the so-called drug war. And they hear the president talking about MS-13.
Sure.
And the president talks about a very violent, dangerous gang. He talks about ICE removing them by the thousands, but a weak border system allowing them to come right back in his words, like water. What do you think we ought to know about what MS-13 is not? What do you think has been characterized fairly and unfairly in the media?
Well, thanks a lot, Evan. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here in Rochester. This is a very complicated issue. The history of MS-13 is that it actually was founded in Los Angeles, California. These are the children of Salvadoran migrants, primarily, who were fleeing civil war in their countries in the early 80s and came to live in the ramparts, for one, in Los Angeles. Those young kids were poor, they were undocumented, they didn't have much, and found themselves faced with very strong Mexican gangs and African-American gangs. And so they began to form their own gangs to protect themselves. The history is complex, but as they began to grow, they became more powerful. And then the U.S. entered into a period of quite significant deportations of these Salvadorans and Central Americans. And so MS-13, born in Los Angeles, is essentially sent back to El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, where there is even less capacity to deal with them. And they really took hold. Many of them didn't have friends, didn't have much family, certainly didn't have employment. And so they became very strong, primarily rooted in communities where they extorted, threatened, stole, sold drugs to these communities in Central America and became quite a powerful organization. I underscore the issue of community because they really are based in neighborhoods throughout El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. People tend to think of them as like, you know, I don't know, General Motors, where there's a real, there's somebody at the top leading them, and it's integrated in such a way that the CEO is telling people what to do. That's really not the case. They're really groups in these different communities have a common brand, do talk to each other, but they're not an armed force that can act together in that sort of way. They've spread through the migrant system, young people trying to get out of the gangs, flee to go back to the United States, you know, and so along the way, new groups form, and this has happened in the U.S. as well. So what you had starting in L.A., sent back to Central America, come back up. Now there's quite a number around Washington, D.C., in Long Island, another area where there's real problems with them. So now, on the numbers front, this is where I differ a little bit with the president, that numbers are not as much as sometimes one is led to believe. For instance, last year, the United States deported a little over 1,000 MS-13 members, not thousands, but just barely over 1,000. I'm not saying it's insignificant, but it's not kind of the hordes that sometimes we can imagine of people coming across. Let me emphasize, these are not charitable groups. We shouldn't confuse them. They're violent. They're criminals. They should be dealt with. But it's a much more complex picture than sometimes we understand. They're gangs rooted in communities, even in the United States. And so addressing the problems in their community, whether it's Salvador or Long Island, is really important and a good way of approaching us.
Eric, I think our listeners would be well served to know if you consider yourself partisan in any way, if your organization considers itself partisan in any way.
Yeah, the Wilson Center was created by an act of Congress as a memorial to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was an academic before he became a politician. But we are by law a nonpartisan organization. We have members of our board that are appointed by President Trump and the leadership in Congress from both political parties. So we strive very much so to be nonpartisan. Obviously, we have our opinion as experts, and that can be complicated, I understand. I have an opinion based on my research, but I'm not trying to argue for the Democrats or for
sure.
the Republicans.
Sure. So. And one thing that, you know, as we go throughout the hour, listeners, if you want to email the program, connections@wxxi.org, U.S.-Mexico policy, the reality of violence and the impact on democratic governance. You can do that there. You can call the program. We'll take some of your phone calls. And people may want to call and ask about the wall. We're going to try to keep it on sort of realistic, substantive policy of what's going okay. on. And the reason I ask about partisanship as well is because when we talk about ICE and when I quote the president, it's not a setup to try to knock the president, nor is it trying to ignore the real concern and danger that, for example, MS-13 members have posed in various places. I mean, that doesn't seek to downplay any of the violence that has been carried out. I do think, as someone who works in a nonpartisan organization, who works with a lot of data, I'd like to ask you if it can be a disservice to the public to sort of hyperbolize these kinds of matters in a way that either ratchets up fear or decontextualizes or just overinflates the risks here. And does that make your job harder to get the public to understand what's going on?
Well, we try to focus on research that's policy relevant, mm-hmm. right? We believe in evidence-informed policy. The best policy is that which is based on evidence, research, and field, you know, what's going on in the field. I realize there can be difference of opinion about that and the conclusions one draws, but our starting point is that, not the political debate, but what are, as best we can, what are the facts that help us deal with these problems? So when I describe MS-13 or other criminal organizations, I try to do it based on what I understand to be the facts, based on my research, and not from the vantage point of a political party or ideology.
Fair enough. So let me just read something that was written for Newsweek as an opinion piece in May by Dora Shiro, who was a founding director of the Federal ICE Office of Detention Policy and Planning. She wrote a piece for Newsweek this past May. The headline was, "Children aren't lining up at the Mexican border to join gangs." And I want to quote from her piece now. She writes, in President Trump's State of the Union speech in January, he said gang members took advantage, in his words, of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as unaccompanied alien minors. The president is calling on the Congress to finally, again in his words, close the deadly loopholes that have allowed MS-13 and other criminal gangs to break into our country. Well, why do some people begrudge others the very things we want for our own children? What is it about a country founded upon the rule of law that characterizes federal statutes, U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and federal consent decrees in which the U.S. government is a party as loopholes? These children who are fleeing violence in their countries need our help. Discouraging foreign-born youth from coming forward for assistance from law enforcement only serves to empower gangs such as MS-13. Misstating crime data is counterproductive. The fact is that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes and less likely to join gangs in the U.S. than U.S.-born individuals, end quote. Do you agree with what she wrote there?
I do in a lot of ways. I do think it's important that we remain focused on the facts. I think that's essential. I think if we don't understand the facts, we're likely to come up with solutions that can actually make the problem worse. I understand motivations may differ, but I do think that understanding the phenomenon of gangs, of violence in Central America and Mexico will help us better design responses. Personally, and this is me speaking personally, I don't think the solution to the problems of gangs and violence in Central America is at the U.S. border. I think the solution to those problems are in the region, in the countries themselves. And that's why I'm anxious that the U.S., under Trump, under Obama, any future president, work together with Central Americans and Mexicans to find solutions there, because the answer is not at the border.
Okay. Listeners, 844-295-TALK if you want to call the program with questions or comments for our guest, Eric Olson, who is a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester. He's in Rochester today. In fact, plane landed within the hour, and he's right here on Connections. He's deputy director of the Latin American Program and senior advisor to the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. His research and writing focuses on security issues and the impacts of crime, organized crime, and violence on democratic governance. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Just that headline from Newsweek, fair or not, or is this too distilled? Children aren't lining up at the Mexican border to join gangs. Yes or no?
I would say they're not.
Okay. And so let's talk about migration of Central Americans coming through Mexico and why largely that migration is happening.
Well, it's a complex issue. There are some issues that draw them to the United States. Many of them, Central Americans, as I say, migrated in the 70s and 80s. So there's a family reunification pull. And when the U.S. economy is going well, there's a pull for jobs. That's clear. But on top of that, or in addition to that, there's some very serious problems in Central America and Mexico that have to do with extreme violence. Mexico experienced its highest level of homicides last year ever. Central America and Northern Triangle, the three countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, are the most violent section of the world or part of the world not at war. So if you take out the Syrians and so on,
sure,
they are the most homicidal. So that is one. In the midst of that kind of violence, economic opportunity is really difficult. And so people do face extraordinary economic deprivation. And the third thing is the failing of their own government. This is the governance question we talk about. The inability of government to protect, to do policing, to prosecute criminals. And some of that has to do with the high levels of corruption in these areas. So if we want to tackle the problem of migration, at its roots, we have to be willing to confront those three key big issues.
And when it comes to the three nations, the three Central American nations that you just mentioned again, are which nations?
Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala.
So when you think about the high level of homicide, the high rate of violence, the difficulty in that landscape of having economic stability, of families finding jobs and having just being able to build stable neighborhoods. It's no wonder that there's this level of migration to our borders. And here's what I think what I don't fully understand about your work, and I want you to help me understand a little bit, Eric. There's this idea that there's essentially two choices, and there's never just two choices on complex policy, but let's go ahead and kind of take the way that in American politics it's been distilled. You either say, we can't turn those people away. Can you imagine what they're going through? War-torn nations, children suffering. You understand why they're at our border. We can't turn them away. Or is this idea that says we can't be responsible for everybody, and by sending them home, we force those nations to confront their own problems more quickly and fix their own problems. I know that's sort of a gross oversimplification, but I wonder if do you have either an affinity for either position? Do you work to create policy based on other directives? Do you advise based on data? How do you sort of approach that bifurcated sense of what we ought to be doing about it?
Well, again, I believe their issues and answers are in the countries themselves.
Okay.
So I think that's where our emphasis should be. I think the reality is, and I have traveled extensively through Central America and southern Mexico, the reality is these are what we would consider war-torn countries in so many ways: high violence, high criminality, lack of protection. So I do worry about sending people back to that situation. Maybe it's a moral issue, but I think at some practical level, sending people back to that violence will generate more migration. Now, the evidence seems to suggest that as this administration has become more strict in family separation, in zero tolerance at the border, they were arguing that that would slow migrations. People would say, oh, no, I can't get in. I'm going to stay home. The evidence is different. The migration continues to go up. We know that that trip from Central America through Mexico is extraordinarily risky. Traffickers, smugglers, violence, extortion. And yet they're coming. So you must wonder, you have to ask yourself, what kind of a decision is a person having to make when they know full well that their child, their family member is going to face these odds on their way, and still they go? Many, and this is anecdotal, but many of them talk about knowing they will be raped, and so they prepare themselves for rape. They know they will be extorted, and so they prepare themselves for that. I mean, that is part of what they understand that role will be. And increasing restrictions at the U.S. border have not, so far, maybe they will, but so far have not proven to change that dynamic.
And so let me follow that up with what we know about the data at the border, what we know about the evidence, in a way that takes a very hot and sensitive emotional issue, which is family separation, and just ask you about the data. Is the threat of family separation, child separation, convincing more people to, quote unquote, stay home and not make the attempt?
It so far, it doesn't appear to be. Now, this is family separation has been going on for a number of years, but this zero tolerance approach is relatively new. In fairness, so far, we have to say it has not showing it. I think it's premised on the notion that somehow we can be, you know, I don't have a better word, we can be crueler than the gangs in Central America, and therefore people won't come. And that's, you know, you can't outdo the gangs in Central America. If you're fleeing cruelty there, efforts to stop them at the border by separating families and by forcing them to do, you know, various things, is just not proven to be effective. That's what I see in the evidence. So I believe the U.S. needs an orderly process of vetting people who seriously face repression or violence upon return. Not everybody should be eligible, but we need that process so that we're not sending people back to these really incredibly violent environments.
There was a moment when the debate was at its sort of most roiling emotional point where a former speechwriter for President Obama posted a picture of of children on what looked like sort of rudimentary mats in a very kind of cage-like setting and said, can you believe we've let our country fall to this point? And it turned out the picture turned out to be from 2014.
Yeah.
And so there are aspects of this that are not new. As you say, the zero-tolerance child separation is rather new. But are there parts as you watch that debate unfold in the media, from everything from the Time magazine cover to the way it was a subject of daily discussion, were we generally getting the facts right or wrong? Is that tough for you to watch these debates when there's so much data out there that is either tossed around correctly or incorrectly? Do you think we were getting it right or wrong?
I believe that we weren't. Let me give you one concrete example. The president made a big deal about a caravan of Central Americans coming to the United States. And I think in the public mind, it was a caravan that was going to, you know, cross the border and blast its way into the United States. In fact, that caravan was formed for self-protection within Mexico. It was really a critique of the inability of Mexico to protect migrants coming through their countries. They face a serious problem at that level. When the migrants got to, before they got to the border, they dispersed and some came in and filed for asylum. Others did not. But that was really about what's going on in Mexico, not about this threat to the national security of the United States. And I think that's one factual point that got missed in that rather emotional debate.
Well, do you think the president cares to get that correct?
I can't read the president's mind. I can't read my wife's mind. I'm not going to be able to read the president's mind. I think that there are people in the White House, including Mr. Stephen Miller, who have a very clear agenda to limit, to prohibit migrants from coming into the United States. They announced yesterday a reduction in the number of refugees coming into the United States, saying that they will compensate that by processing more asylum claims from Central America. I'm not questioning that, but it's very clear that that's a motivation for a lot of their policy.
Sure. Okay, fair enough. And again, data, not emotion, not partisan. What does the data say about the rates of crimes committed by immigrants, migrants who are documented, undocumented?
Well, I'm not the foremost expert on criminality in the United States,
okay,
but what I've read is that it is equal to or less than
the
general population in the United States.
Okay.
That's
probably a data point that matters.
I think it is.
Okay. Before I get to some of your questions that have come in by email, again, I'll tell you, if you want to talk about U.S.-Mexico policy, trying to understand the impact of violence, the current state of affairs in Mexico and in Central America, Eric Olson is one of the really foremost experts on that, is a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester. He just landed in Rochester late this morning and is actually early this afternoon and is right here on Connections with us. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So as you talk about addressing the problem at its root in, for example, those three Central American countries, does that mean more intervention of U.S. policy? Does that mean more sort of active aid, mutual aid enforcement? What does that look like at its root in those places where the criminality is so high, where the homicide rates are so high?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because something we wrestle with. And on the one hand, I mean, the simple answer to your question is yes. It means more engagement in Central America. Now, do I mean by that throwing more money at problems that are intractable when governments aren't committed to kind of the reforms they need? No. More is not always better. But you can't turn your back from the problems there. It requires smart, intelligent engagement. There's a myriad of problems, and you can't address all those. I think you have to prioritize and focus first on the problems of corruption in those countries. Because if the governments can't function, can't deliver and protect their citizens, then we're essentially doing it for them. And that's not a long-term solution. The U.S. doesn't want to be permanently involved in running countries like Honduras, Salvador, and Guatemala. Guatemalans don't want that either. The Central Americans don't want it either. But we need to put them and encourage them on a pathway so they can themselves take care of these problems.
And what is one mechanism short of, you know, participating in a coup that allows that to happen?
Well, we have, as the United States, and when I say we, I mean the United States, has invested in some really innovative mechanisms for fighting corruption in Honduras and Guatemala. These have been mechanisms that have been set up by the United Nations and the Organization of American States that assist the attorneys general of those countries. There's so much corruption in the attorney general's office that they can't do the investigations of the corrupt officials. So the UN, the OAS, with U.S. support, has managed to investigate, has succeeded in removing a president in Guatemala through a legal system, not a coup. But we're beginning to see for the first time some accountability for corruption in these countries. And I think that's a real hopeful sign.
Yeah, I would think that the American history, I know there are very sensitive debates about our actions in regards to other sovereign states regarding their leadership, our, even if it's well-intentioned, the idea of removing leadership, installing new leadership, whether it's through, again, through coup, through installation, or through democratic legal means. Some Americans are just getting very hesitant about picking winners and losers abroad at all. Though our track record is so spotty that it is a very risky enterprise, and that it's often a bad option in power versus several other sort of equally bad or possibly very corruptible options, right, that there aren't sort of easy and pure installable or electable options. And so some throw up their hands and say, that's not our problem anymore. We can't figure out how to. And I wonder, because I think that's a really well-intentioned feeling.
Yeah, no. I'm not unsympathetic to that view, because sometimes it's very frustrating. And I think it's a legitimate question. I approach it this way, understanding the poor options we have. I also think that remaining engaged in those countries, and I emphasize that word because it's not just about money, but it's really being present and engaged, is vitally important. If we turn our backs on Honduras, if we turn our backs on Guatemala and Salvador, those countries could very well become narco states. I mean, they are in some instances already in a limited sense, but they could really turn into narco states. And when you have a situation such as that, that opens the door to other terrorist organization. That opens the door to a lot. So if we think we have a migration issue now with Central America, what do you think would happen if those countries fell into the hands of criminals and they become criminal states? Then you'll see even more migration and more threats to the United States. These countries are not that far from the U.S. border, and so we need to invest in making sure they are democratic, well-governed countries, or we're going to pay the price in the long run.
Yeah, it sounds like the idea of non-intervention on any level is not a choice you think we ultimately have, that eventually we'd be forced into some kind of response.
Exactly. I think if we believe, and I've heard military people say this, U.S. military say, if we're defending the homeland on the border with Mexico, we lost already. Once the football is on the one-yard line, it's over. They're going to score. So we need to work in Mexico, in Central America, to make sure those countries are democratic, are transparent, are not corrupt, and not a breeding ground for the kinds of violent criminal activity and terrorism that we fear in other parts of the world.
I've got a lot of phone calls and emails to get through. I'm going to start with Mark in Seneca Falls. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, thank you for having me on. I'm so grateful to hear an experienced voice promoting these policy solutions. And my question is, where in our government do we have the capacity or the political will to implement some of these ideas in these Central American countries? And are there, can you name some champions within our institutions and our government to push these ideas forward?
Very good question, Mark. And you know, oftentimes we don't see the people in the background doing the work. I do believe there are people in the State Department who believe and understand that and have advised a continued engagement in Central America. People at the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. For me, some of the greatest heroes, though, are at the U.S. embassies in these countries. Sure, there are problems and policies that we can criticize, but these are people there on the ground who see and know on a daily basis. Oftentimes, their advice is even ignored by policymakers in the United States, but they're there trying to remain engaged. And despite the change in the dynamics with the Trump administration, there are still programs funded by the United States in communities that are trying to address some of these problems. So to me, they're heroes. If I said their names, they would be embarrassed and be mad at me. So I don't say it, but I think there are a lot of great people in the embassies in these countries.
Mark, you want to follow up?
Well, I can appreciate that. I just hope that we can build some momentum towards engaging these folks and letting them do their jobs and guiding us to the right outcomes. So I'll follow this going forward. And again, I appreciate your thoughts.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. Go ahead, Eric.
No. Thank you too, Mark. I think we are engaged. We haven't completely pulled away. There have been different threats at different points to cut off aid and walk away. Sometimes, look at countries, the Congress people tell you this all the time, no country has a right to U.S. assistance. So there's always going to be an implied ability to pull back. And sometimes that's appropriate. But to simply turn one's back on countries that are deeply troubled, I think is short-sighted, and we need to remain engaged.
Let me get back to your phone calls. Richard in Canandaigua next. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, yes, I agree that it's in our interest for Central America to be able to, you might say, join the economic or rise to the economic and social and political level that we have achieved in terms of not just prosperity, material prosperity, but moral and political, the stage that we've gotten to. Well, what bothers me about this obscene current antagonism to immigration is that basically we're sabotaging the best for one of the best resources for helping us achieve that down there, and that's namely the pattern we see with so many immigrants. We certainly saw this from the Mexicans over the last 40, 50 years. They come up, they get a job, they send money home, people begin to prosper a little more at home, and they then take it from the grassroots level to deal with the political corruption and the political stagnation in their countries. And that would be the same thing so, over time that would happen if this nonsensical immigration, this blocking of immigration were to continue. I mean, it is short-sighted, but besides being immoral and cruel. Well, it's short-sighted in terms of our own, doesn't serve our own interest in the long run.
All right. Well, Richard, thanks for that. Let me ask Eric, do you agree with Richard's idea that migrants come here, learn, settle down, and then send money home and improve the economy in their native lands?
That is certainly true in many instances. Salvador receives roughly 18% of its gross domestic product from what are called remittances. That's money being sent back. Similarly in Honduras and Guatemala. So a big chunk of their economy is actually money being sent back from people working in the United States. Now, there are two interesting things here. Traditionally, before, and this is way before Donald Trump, I mean, this is 20, 30 years ago, traditionally, migration from Mexico was very circular. People came up to the United States, worked in the fields, worked in construction, and at the end of the season, went back home. As the U.S. has thickened the border, made it more complicated to get into the United States and crack down on the border, fewer and fewer of the migrants are returning, right? Because it's risky. They're staying, and that circular nature of migration has been largely broken when it comes to U.S. and Mexico. There's more permanent migration, and people are trying to bring the rest of their family up because they know they can't go back at Christmas and go see them. The second thing, and this is maybe related to this question from Richard, there is a group of Salvadorans and Hondurans who were allowed to stay legally in the United States because their countries experienced terrific natural disasters. They're called people with temporary protected status, and they've been in the U.S. almost 20 years. If you look at that slice of people that's been here legally for 20 years, home ownership in that group is above what the national average is. They've sought more education. They have saved more. I mean, that's a microcosm of legal migrants in this country. The Trump administration has decided to end that program and send all these people back after 20 years in this country. For Salvadorans, there's about 195,000 of them in that program. They have 193,000 U.S. citizen children. So you think about if you send that 195,000 back to El Salvador by terminating, what's going to happen to those U.S. citizen children? Some of them are a little bit older now, but many of them are quite young. What are we going to do with those folks? Deport U.S. citizens? Are we going to create mechanisms to deal with them as their families are pulled apart? What do you do with the trauma that these children face? We know that trauma of that sort, when you're early in life, has long-term implications in terms of employment, criminal activity, consumption of illicit substances, all those things. And so I think sometimes we don't think long-term about these questions of deportation and return, because there is what they experience is quite different than simply returning and being done with it.
I'm late for our only break, and I'm going to come back to your phone calls and emails. I got some really thoughtful and good questions for Eric Olson, who is our guest for the hour. He's Deputy Director of the Latin American Program and Senior Advisor to the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. His work focuses on security issues and the impacts of crime and organized crime and violence. And he's in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester. He's got an event tonight, but it's sold out. And what you ought to know about this is that the World Affairs Council, they bring in throughout the fall and into the winter a number of international experts like Eric Olson. And this is the start of their fall and winter programs. And so they've got more coming up here. So tonight's event sold out. But if you wanted to get in touch with the World Affairs Council, the man you ought to get in touch with is Bob Gerace. And his email is rgerace1@rochester.rr.com. It's RGERACE1 at rochester.rr.com if you want to be involved with future events that they've got happening right here in Rochester. Let's get that break and back to your questions for Eric Olson next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, a conversation about Judge Brett Kavanaugh and the Raise the Age campaign. Advocates for raising the age of criminal responsibility have wanted 18 to be the age for adult criminal responsibility. And now some defenders of Brett Kavanaugh say you can't support raising the age and also want to hold him accountable for what he might have done when he was 17. Our panel discusses it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm always so gratified by the outstanding questions that come from our listening audience, either via phone or via email. They're the reason we've got such good content for our guests here. And I think the next question is another great example of a really smart question. It comes from Daniel. And he has a question for Eric Olson. He says, I understand that the triangle of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have deep and systemic problems of corruption and violence. What are countries like Nicaragua, Panama, Costa Rica, and Belize getting right? Can these countries have a positive impact on their neighbors?
That's a very good question. I would not include Nicaragua as a shining example of what should be done. It's a country now in absolute turmoil, with a strongman president, albeit elected, somebody who's very authoritarian, and they're facing major crisis. I think the numbers are around 400 people have been killed there in political violence since April. So I would bracket them out. Likewise, Belize is a tiny country. I think it's less than 500,000 people. Have some good things. I'm not, you know, dissing Belize, but they struggle with some of their own issues. Costa Rica is really the outlier here, and to some extent Panama as well. Costa Rica is a country that has believed in and invested in the rule of law for the last 60 years now, I believe, since they were independent. They dissolved their military and decided that they would invest in civilian institutions like the rule of law. And they really are a shining example of a country that can prosecute, can hold people accountable, and be responsible. Do they have challenges? Of course. Criminal organizations want to be there too. But the levels of corruption are not what they are in these other countries. And part of this is having created the institutions of government that function. It sounds boring to say it that way, but when you look at the examples, there you have it. Panama, too, has turned a corner after the Noriega intervention by the United States. They kind of got their house in order. They have become a center for financial services, banking. They have the canal, of course, which makes them, you know, wildly successful. They have been running the canal as a state-owned enterprise ever since the late 70s, very successfully. They just doubled its size with a new canal. So they have gone, you know, very much in the direction of enterprise and public enterprise and financing, and Costa Rica invested in their institutions. And I think those are things that could be learned from the other countries.
When you mentioned Costa Rica building these institutions up, that it kind of sounds boring. I guess it sounds mildly banal, but it also sounds important. And I'm wondering if what happens is a combination of some kind of civic engagement on the part of the populace, the voting populace. Is it luck? I mean, literally just electing people who are less corruptible and less sort of susceptible to power and all that it offers? I'm wondering what kind of formula.
Well, I'm enough of a political scientist that I don't believe much in luck
okay.
when it comes
Fair
to
enough.
These things.
Fair
I mean,
enough.
I'm sure others might see it differently. But I do believe that there have been leaders in these countries, especially in Costa Rica, that had the vision for developing independent prosecutors and tribunals and have really invested in strengthening their own government. It's partly a demand on the part of Costa Ricans that their government be much cleaner. They've had corruption problems. But so have we, as we know, in the United States as well. But they have the wherewithal, the institutions to deal with the corruption. They have invested enormously in quality education in Costa Rica, some of the highest and best quality public education, and that contributes as well. So there's a lot of factors that I don't think are just luck, are really people making important and good decisions.
All right, Robert in Fairport is next on the phone. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I don't kind of understand, you know, one of the statements that was made earlier that it's okay for the U.S. to kind of enact or greatly help a regime change in Guatemala, which is a sovereign country, and then, you know, have all these complaints that Russia is trying to influence the American election. It just seems like they're incompatible and inconsistent. If these countries are sovereign nations, why are we trying to change leadership and change their governments?
Fair question, a good question. I appreciate it because it made me, I need to clarify. I'm not, when we talk about regime change, we're talking about overthrowing a government. And I would never suggest that the United States is trying to do that in Guatemala. That the U.S. is investing in trying to encourage Guatemala to be a more democratic society, less corruption, and improve, and maybe to some extent change the way the government operates, yes, but not to overthrow the government.
Okay, but for even outside of overthrowing, I think Robert would say what we know is that Russia has tried to intervene in our elections in various ways to try to influence an outcome. And sure. if we are doing the same thing sure. elsewhere, are we hypocrites?
Well, except for the difference being here that Guatemala has agreed to. It's above board. It's not through fake Facebook things of intervention or Twitter accounts. This is an open agreement between the state of Guatemala and the United States. And it's a plan to deal with these issues. So, yes, it's intervening, but it's intervening with the acquiescence, with the acceptance of these governments, not some sort of backhanded way.
All right, let me try to get through as many other questions. We've got a lot. This is Rick in Rochester. Next, go ahead, Rick.
With the acquiescence, with the acceptance of
these governments. Oh, Rick, I'm sorry. Hey, good example there from Rick. If you're on the phone, have it turned down and just listen through your phone because there's a little bit of a delay. Let me get back to some other questions that have come in. Noel wanted to know, wouldn't it be cheaper to go to El Salvador and have the Marines get rid of the gangs?
Well, let's assume for a minute that they could do that. I don't believe they can because these are problems rooted in communities and they reflect social dynamics, not just ones where you're going to go imprison everybody. But does the U.S. really want to run El Salvador, have the Marines on the ground? That's an enormously expensive undertaking. And it means that those countries are going to be dependent on the U.S. permanently. I think the better strategy is to try to address the problems and move in the direction of self-government, self-sufficiency, and better approaches to these. Rather than sending in the Marines, we can't send the Marines into every problem area of the world.
This morning before, I should say in advance of your visit today, a listener named Mark, a different Mark, emailed just to ask if you think that the criminalization of drugs and that the drug war itself on an international level has been a failure, and that if we see more widespread legalization, do we take out the criminal element in these nations?
Well, that's a pretty big question. I think we have, 3 minutes left? But let me say this.
Yes.
Obviously, it depends what yardstick you want to use. But if the war on drugs, you know, whatever that means, but if the war on drugs, if we're deciding whether it's a failure based on whether drugs are still coming into the country, still being produced, and still being consumed, let's not forget that. It's about also the demand. Then I'd say you'd have to say overall it's not worked. It's been a failure. Now, the opposite solution is, do we legalize drugs and therefore this problem goes away? Keep in mind that the biggest source of problem consumption of drugs in the United States are prescription drugs. That's a legal regulated market that becomes used by problem consumers. So simply creating a legal regulated market, even of heroin, is no guarantee that you won't have the kind of horrific social problems and deaths you do in this country. You may change the definition of the problem, I grant you that, but the problem is not going to go away. It's still there.
You mentioned earlier this hour that Mexico, what, last year had its highest level of homicide ever?
Correct, yes.
There's some new leadership in Mexico. They had elections not too long ago. Are you optimistic that the new leadership is going to address this in a way that's effective?
Well, it's a little too early to say, but I don't want to evade your question. His name is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He was elected primarily for two reasons. Unbelievable corruption in Mexico, probably the number one issue. And the second issue is high levels of violence, and people are disgusted and upset about it. That tells you that at least he understands what his priorities are. And he said, these are my priorities. How he's going to address that, he's not in office yet. We don't know fully yet. He has some good ideas of retargeting these the programs in certain areas. Others I'm not so sure about. We'll just have to see. You know, he takes office in December 1, and hopefully by then he'll have a team in place and concrete ideas. I'm hopeful, trying to be realistic, that nobody's solving any of these problems quickly. Certainly the United States is not. But look, it's time to be hopeful. Why not?
One of the takeaways as we get into our last minute, Eric, in about 45 seconds, one of the takeaways I think that I'm feeling from this conversation with you is that maybe you think that there's too much focus on what's happening right at the border, obsession, do we build a wall or not, what's happening at the border when these problems have much deeper roots, farther geographic roots. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. It's farther, deeper roots in the region. And then, of course, we haven't even addressed the issue of consumption of illicit drugs in the United States, which at the end of the day is what all this is about. People trying to get a product to market, and along the way that results in a lot of violence.
And that's a super complex problem. I mean, in some parts of our country, that goes to joblessness, it goes to hollowed out communities,
exactly.
Collapsed economies, changes in manufacturing and expectation of just quality of life, hopeless.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a very complex and long-running problem.
Absolutely.
But I do appreciate the expertise you brought, and really sort of the cool-headed look at facts and data. I think it's really good for our audience to hear it at a time where, and again, not pointing fingers directly at any one person or even an administration, but there's a lot of heat, and I think a cool-headed approach is important here. So thanks for being here, and we really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it, Evan, and congratulations on great listeners and great questions.
Yeah, they are. It's an outstanding audience, and we're very proud of that. Eric Olson is in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council of Rochester. He's here tonight, the Deputy Director of the Latin American Program and Senior Advisor to the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., with the focus on security, crime, and violence. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.